2001 Salt Lake Sunstorm Symposium Session 313, a most outrageously ambitious project, the history of the Sunstorm Review, 1981-84. Participants John R. Silico and Lori Winder Stromberg.
Mormon Thought and Letters from Exile, the correspondence of Martha Hughes and Angus M. Cannon, both published by Signature Books. He currently serves as a member of the Charles Redd Center Advisory Council. So John was recognized as Distinguished Honors Professor at Weber State in 1989 and Honors Service Professor in 1993. John and I worked together at Sunstone on the magazine and the review, where he was the book review editor. And except for a few friends in high school who flirted with socialism, John is the first and probably remains the only person I know who is a card-carrying socialist.
Well, here I am with technology. Let's see if this works. I don't know where to put it right here. Well, I appreciate you being here. Let me give you some background. This is part of a series of essays that was commissioned for the magazine to talk about the history of Sunstone. Articles on the different editors, article on the symposium, and an article on the Sunstone Review. I was going to bring a copy of the review with me in case you haven't seen one, but I forgot because I got home late last night. But if you haven't seen the review, you might want to take a look at it sometime. It's an interesting publication. In a 1981 letter to Richard John Newhouse, Peggy Fletcher solicited the theologian's interest in the Sunstone Review, calling it the newest and most outrageously ambitious effort undertaken by the Sunstone Foundation. Fletcher was correct. Over the course of the next 3 years, this publication would see both successes and failures, high hopes and disappointments. Indeed, as Robert Peck has described it, the Sunstone Review was a heroic project, worthy in its own right, but shrewdly undertaken to make loads of money to subsidize Sunstone Magazine. And that's the key point, loads of money. While the review ended up a financial failure, however, Peck realized that it also grandly stretched the boundaries and vision of both the magazine and the foundation. The story of this short-lived publication is more than simply an aside in a larger history. Indeed, the review represented a major coming together of all the elements that prompted Sunstone's creation, while simultaneously containing all of the internal contradictions and tensions that always made Sunstone problematic. A full examination of the Sunstone Review would be impossible in the time available to me. Rather, in this overview, I intend to examine five aspects of the history of Sunstone Review. What were its origins? What did it seek to accomplish? What did its pages feature? Why did it fail? And what was its impact? Moreover, please note that I write from the perspective of someone who was deeply involved with the review as a writer and an editor, and someone who shared the assumptions that led to its creation. The Sunstone Review was announced in a letter from Peggy Fletcher to magazine subscribers in May of 1981. Fletcher described it as a bi-monthly LDS newspaper, which would constitute a supplement in the magazine and provide readers with additional news, book reviews, arts calendar, and other information. By the end of the year, however, plans had changed, and a separate publication was envisioned. In letters to regular contributors to the magazine, managing editor Susan Staker noted that the new publication would be monthly and take all the news feature columns from the magazine, Onefold, Update, Mormon Media, and People, and put them only in the review, she said, because to do otherwise would be too complicated. Peggy Fletcher's role in all of the efforts involved in planning and creating the review was central. While the review was formally announced in 1981, something like it had been in her mind for some time. Fletcher remembers her thoughts about beginning such a publication as a sort of revelatory experience in response to her wondering why Sunstone Magazine was not expanding its readership. Lots of people were egging me on, Fletcher noted, Albert Peck, Larry Winder, Susan Staker, and many others. Peck recalled that there was a culture of commitment surrounding Fletcher that attracted like-minded individuals.
According to Peck, she looked outward to several national publications, institutions, and forums, and said, "We can do that in the Mormon community, too." Stern concurs with Peck's assessment. Peggy gave the review energy. She was the catalyst. Peggy believed in dreaming big and getting others to do the same. The review was closely identified with Peggy personally, but maybe that personalization had limitations, too. Indeed, Fletcher believed that Mormons needed to be involved in and engaged with the larger world around them. Mormons needed to examine all kinds of issues and events that impacted on them and their world. Such engagements would be facilitated by a publication like the Sunstone Review. As indicated, the review sought to be a forum for disseminating information on current events, the arts, and people from a Mormon perspective. Again, Peggy Fletcher's role was central. First and foremost, the publication was geared toward a popular audience. As Fletcher recalled, "I vividly remember Chris Arrington saying to me, 'Lots of people are taking the church news. Why not create something that would reach a similar audience of interested Mormons?'" For Fletcher, there were several key questions. What are Mormons saying? What are Mormons doing? And what is happening in the Mormon community? All of this was predicated on a fundamental belief that Mormons were also part of a larger community as well. As Staker remembered, the review sought to bring a Mormon worldview and Mormon sensibility to an examination of books, movies, politics, current events, even world affairs. "We kept asking," she says, "how do those values affect the way you see the world and help you to make connections with it?" In the beginning, some people believed that a good model was People magazine, arguing that the review's success rested in direct proportion to the number of familiar names it contained. While the publication would eventually contain many familiar names, Fletcher remembered being more influenced by Time and the New York Times. As Albert Peck recalled, the scope and format was really Peggy's idea. She had done the research. In addition to Time and the New York Times, I think another key model was the New York Review of Books. Peggy was influenced by and became friends with national writers like Ken Woodward, Peter and Margaret Steinfeld, and many others. What they were writing and the kinds of publications they worked for helped Peggy envision what would eventually become the Sunstone Review. Central in all of the discussions about starting the review was a belief that timeliness was the key to making the new publication successful. In an important sense, the review became the key to financing everything else. It occurred to me, Fletcher remembered, why not create a more frequent, cheaper publication that could be distributed free? In the magazine, ads were often infrequent and late, but if the review was current, and that's the big if the review was current, Fletcher felt, the ads would follow. Fletcher also believed that with a wider circulation, the review could attract national ads and others that the magazine couldn't sell successfully. As Staker recalled, it was basically Peggy's idea to make money, defray overhead of the magazine, and support other Sunstone activities. "We were absolutely convinced that if we got enough ads, the review could be profitable, even if we gave it away." In addition to the format itself, an examination of the motivations of those involved with creating the publication is also, I think, revealing. As Peck honestly admits, in some ways the review represented an elitist view of the Mormon world. Simultaneously paternalistic and idealistic, it was literally an enlightenment project that would examine the arts, literature, and architecture, etc. At the same time, Peck commented that the impetus for the review was clearly generational. "I think it was axiomatic and self-evident that this generation of Mormons who were college-educated, reared in a larger American tradition, colored and defined by 60s values, influenced by things like Vietnam and Watergate, and who valued the role of investigative journalism, would want to start something like the review. It reflected the times and the events around us." For review organizers and staffers, critic was not a bad word, nor a negative concept. For them, the key question was simple. Had Mormonism reached a point where its institutions could be seen as fair game for investigative reporting? As Fletcher phrased it, "We were not intent on being the watchdog, but simply examining what was happening in the Mormon world." When Stenker reflected on her experiences during those years, she noted, "I went from the church historical department to Sunstone. It was a logical move. I met Peggy when she was working for Leonard Arrington. In a sense, the review seemed like a logical extension, too. Same people, same issues. The review was certainly a logical extension of things like the symposium. I think it grew out of the symposium and the idea of starting a conversation, reaching out, finding new writers and new approaches. It was part of our spoken and unspoken commitment to open up the Mormon world to a wider world, and the wider world to Mormons. Initially, there was no sense that working at Sunstone was a threat. Later, that would change." Fletcher and her colleagues also believed that if the publication was flexible and current, it could gain a wide ecumenical audience that attracted more than Mormons. Indeed, the review introduced a new concept into the mix. As Stenker wrote at the time, the review sought to reach a broader audience, not just Mormons and ex-Mormons, but also Mormon watchers. Primarily non-Mormon, these Mormon watchers were interested in a series of questions not traditionally part of the Mormon publishing scene, including issues of power and influence, financial dealings, and attempts on the part of the church to suppress intellectual and personal freedom. When reporting on these issues became an integral feature of the review, it inevitably led to conflict with the church hierarchy. For all of these reasons, the review increasingly took up the lion's share of Fletcher's time. Staff meeting minutes in the summer of 1982 noted that overseeing the editorial aspects of the review would be a major part of her responsibility. Printed on newsprint and magazine size, Volume 1, Number 1, dated July-August 1981, set the pattern for future issues of the publication. While the first issue carried a cover price of 70 cents, the publication was distributed without charge. The lead news articles were stories about the Sundance Film Institute and the First Presidency's statement concerning basing of the MX missile in Nevada and Utah. In addition, there were several departments examining associations, Mormon media image, movies, people, and update. The premier issue also had reviews of both Mormon and non-Mormon books. In a less than subtle way, reviews were clearly tied to ads. In the first issue, for example, a review of Mormonism and the American Experience ran on the same page as an ad for that book. This was true for other titles, such as Arts and Inspiration, Heber C. Kimball, Mormon Patriarch and Pioneer, and On Being a Christian and a Lawyer. In addition to books, there were a number of other ads as well. Some were public service ads, including the Utah Opera Company, the Utah Arts Council. Many ads were for Sunstone products or programs, and a few others were clearly commercial, including ads for Bennett Paint, Stevens Henniger College, and the Cosmic Airplane Book and Records, several home storage companies, and products. Finally, there was a small number of classified ads at 25 cents per word, paid in advance with a 10-word minimum. The first issue also featured a scriptural commentary by Stephen F. Christensen, responding to the question, "As a result of being responsible for the murder of Uriah, will David join the ranks of the sons of perdition?" I think the answer was no. Christensen's column would only continue for two issues. By then, however, Christensen's picture began appearing in ads for his father's Mr. Max men's clothing store. While the basic format remained the same for several issues, an increasing number of investigative pieces appeared. Bob Gottlieb and Peter Wiley, then working on their important study, America's Saints, examined Zion and Gomorrah, a two-part series on Mormon involvement with politics, development, and gaming in Las Vegas. Other important investigative stories included an examination of the 1982 Denver Post's weekly magazine story on the church, an examination of isolation among general authorities, and a two-part series by Susan Staker running in the July 1982 issue under the title Mormon Church from Cult to World Faith, and in the August issue as Are Mormons Christian? The August issue also included a story that would later prove to be very historically significant. Titled Behind the Scenes, The Joseph Smith III Blessing, the story included an account of the discovery of the blessing by Mark Hoffman, and responses by RLDS church historian Richard Howard and Donald T. Schmidt, who is the director of the church's library archives. While hard news stories caught attention, increasingly book reviews became a significant component of the publication. Over time, many of the titles reviewed were not LDS, and often reflected the expertise and interests of the review staff. At the same time, book reviews were also problematic. For example, Doyle Fitzpatrick, author of A Study of James Strang, wrote to Nicole Hoffman complaining that the review of his book was rather insulting. He went on to say that he assumed that from your viewpoint, meaning Sunstone's, the reviewer did not say the right things, meaning he represented an anti-Strang Mormon bias. Fitzpatrick noted that the reviewer must have succeeded because only two copies of my book were sold, even though I had a one-third page ad in the issue. In addition to reviews of single books, a number of review essays appeared which brought attention to a particular genre or a specific topic or author. Levina Fielding Anderson and Pamela Gilley Carson examined Mormon Mushies, The Wonderful World of the Sugar-Coated, a four-part series on the number and variety of Mormon romance novels that has multiplied exponentially in the past several years. Anderson also examined four different books on Mormon women in a review essay titled All Sweetness and Light. As Anderson observed, the good news is that publishers for the Mormon market are willing to do books for women. The bad news is that this particular handful is pretty poor stuff, and that women in most cases would be better off reading Claudia Bushman's Mormon Sisters. The April May 1983 issue contained an excellent review article on Wallace Stegner, The Writer as Seer, by historian Gary Topping. Peter Wiley's review of Richard Lamb and Michael McCarthy's The Angry West, A Vulnerable Land and Its Future, served as a springboard for a discussion of the possibility of the American West gaining control of its destiny in the face of the continuing concentration of political and economic power in the hands of big government and major corporations. In my own case, an essay by University of Utah English professor Brooke Hopkins, discussing four works by Thomas Merton, first introduced me to the Catholic monk and writer whose life and thought would become so important to me personally. Also significant were attempts to broaden readership awareness of recently published titles. This was done through listings of largely non-Mormon regional bestsellers and a separate list of LDS bestsellers. Additionally, a column compiled by Linda Thatcher reported on recent Mormon titles. Indeed, while the review regularly featured significant national books, it also marked the first serious attempt to understand the Mormon publishing market as well. Throughout its existence, the review covered national stories which seemed to have a Mormon slant. For example, Peggy Fletcher told Russell Chandler of the Los Angeles Times that the coverage of Eldridge Cleaver's growing attachment to Mormonism was a scoop. I haven't seen it in any other papers. Another important story surrounded the activities of Mormon feminist and anti-EOA activist Sonia Johnson. The review dealt with Johnson's excommunication, as well as her efforts to head the National Organization for Women and her 1984 Citizens Party presidential bid. Fletcher was never noted for being shy about proclaiming the importance of the review to a larger audience. On one occasion, she sent copies of the publication to members of the National Book Critics Circle Committee, noting that because it was one of the few publications which offers cogent reviews of national and regional books in the Intermountain West, it might help you in your selection process to pay attention to those books which are significant regionally. Reflecting her deeply held commitment to ecumenical dialogue, Fletcher also actively sought exchanges of the review and the magazine with a wide variety of non-Mormon publications. In addition to the articles and reviews themselves, one of the most significant and long-lasting accomplishments of the Sunstone Review was its ability to network, bringing together a group of established Mormon commentators with talented new writers and potential supporters. Its pages also featured a significant group of thinkers from outside of the Mormon circle. At the risk of failing to mention important contributors, a listing of the following individuals helps make the point. Church employees who wrote for the review included Levina Fielding Anderson, Glenn Leonard, and Davis Bitten. Similarly, two important RLDS writers, Paul Edwards and Bill Russell, were featured. As might be suspected, academics were frequent contributors. Among writers from BYU were Eloise Bell, Karen Lynn, Eugene Campbell, Dwayne Jeffrey, Reba Keel, Richard Craycroft, Bruce Jorgensen, Eugene England, Jim Dark, and Tom Alexander. Other academics from inside and outside of Utah included Doug Alder, Richard Sadler, Val Avery, Levi Peterson, Robert B. Smith, Larry Gerlach, F. Allen Coombs, Scott Abbott, Catherine McKay, and Laurel Thatcher Ulrich. Moreover, a number of contributors came from outside of the academy. Among those were Greta Peterson, Martha Bradley, Clifton Holt Jolly, Linda Silito, Susan Tabor, Michael Walton, Alan Roberts, Robert Fletcher, Herbert Harker, Kerry Bate, Ann Edwards Cannon, and Gary Bergera. The review also attracted a number of non-Mormon writers as well, including Jan Shipp, Stephen Stein, Harris Lenowitz, Horace McMullen, Francis Farley, Quinn Brisbane, and the previously mentioned Bob Gottlieb and Peter Wiley. As the staff grew, it also brought together a group of talented people. Among those associated with the review were Albert Peck, Brian Boone, Scott Dunn, Larry Winder, Cecilia Warner, Nicole Hoffman, and many others. Finally, throughout its existence, the review also served as a conduit for information, rumors, recriminations, and revelations. As one who was there, I well remember the sense of excitement of making history and of being at the center of what was happening in the Mormon milieu that seemed ever-present in the Sunstone offices in the old Bennett Paint Building. In Susan Staker's words, the staff discovered that many of us and many of our readers were struggling with the church. In both cases, most were trying to stay in the church. There was little talk of leaving. Over time, however, Sunstone in all of its forms became a kind of nexus of pain and a center of angst. Because the review dealt with current issues and seemed to be a lightning rod, the atmosphere was thick with intrigue and heightened intensity. Though the Sunstone Review began with high hopes and anticipation, ultimately it proved unsuccessful. When the final issue appeared in April of 1984, the cover story on General Conference asked the question, whence and whither? It's an appropriate question to ask of the Sunstone Review as well. While many factors came into play, the reasons for its demise can probably be traced to four: finances, internal tensions, opposition from the church, and division among Sunstone supporters over the new venture. Finances were always an issue. The overhead was high, with staff salaries, equipment needs, and production costs constantly increasing. And it must also be remembered that the review expenses were only part of the larger funding needs of the magazine and the symposium. Moreover, because there was so much emphasis placed on the profitability of the review as the solution to all of Sunstone's economic needs, its lack of profit was a major setback. Looking back, Fletcher called the review a good idea which was not well thought out and undercapitalized. The biggest problem was that there were no business people on board to create a plan to raise money. We all thought it would start out in the red, but survive and turn a profit. It never did. What few business people I knew lacked real enthusiasm for the project, but there wasn't any real opposition, so I just charged ahead and the staff supported the decision. Our finances were just too thin to sustain everything, and I never really could sell the concept to the people who could have raised the money. At the same time, Fletcher admits she didn't listen carefully to the business people because they were generally so negative to the idea. And I guess I interpret that as snobbishness or simply missing the boat on the importance of contemporary issues. And as I say, there was so much enthusiasm from other quarters, I should have cashed it in sooner, but I loved the review and I just wanted it to continue. Lots of others loved it too, just not enough. By the beginning of the third year, Fletcher realized something needed to be done. Advertising was not producing the revenue expected and needed. She wrote a long and revealing letter to one Sunstone supporter, noting that while talking about developments in the intellectual community was what really gave her pleasure, unfortunately, she said, I also have to hold together this constantly sinking ship. Fletcher detailed the problems she was facing. Predictably, Sunstone is experiencing its annual crisis. We have an issue of the magazine at the press, which they won't print for lack of payment, and another in the wings with the same problem. The review is likewise behind. The March issue just came out, but because neither it nor the February issues have yet been paid for, the printer refuses, with good reason, to print the April issue. saying she still believed it was possible to create the Time magazine of Mormonism and be successful. Fletcher said she had found a first-rate advertising salesman, but in order for him to be able to sell a reasonable amount of advertising, we need to overprint and distribute the review in fairly significant quantities. Because the cost of the salesman and the additional issues would add $2,000 an issue to the cost, she provided this supporter with a detailed budget and appealed for additional funds to help get the review off the ground, funds that were not forthcoming. Fletcher indicated she was committed to try this experiment, as it is the only way to make the review ultimately self-supporting. Fletcher summarized that if we had one full year with a complete skeleton staff and enough money to print on time, at the end of that year, it would be entirely self-sustaining. Despite Fletcher's optimism, not only did the review fail to become self-supporting, but things got worse. As Susan Staker told one writer, because of financial difficulties, the review suspended publication for 3 months earlier this year and has since had to cut back the number of pages. We hope to soon be back on our feet, but we will publish fewer book reviews. Seeking answers, Fletcher appealed for additional help. Looking back, she recalled that toward the end of the year, Tom Miner, a University of Utah business student, came on board and helped me see the real financial side, helped me see how bleak the prospects were. Unlike many of the other business people, Tom really loved the review but realized it wasn't working. He suggested we combine the best of the review into the magazine and seek to make it really appear monthly. He really gave us a graceful way out of our dilemma. Similar advice came from other quarters as well. One advisor, Charles Randall Paul, wrote to Fletcher in the summer of 1984, "Don't waste your effort on two publications. Make Sunstone more like the review and vice versa. By doing away with the review completely, incorporate the best elements into the magazine. Make the magazine cheaper to produce, but do not compromise on content." Fletcher recalls with little fondness the personal nature of fundraising, often relying on family and personal friends for monetary support for Sunstone. At the same time, the single Fletcher was living a frugal and Spartan lifestyle, with most of her time and energy devoted to Sunstone. And I think she felt like all the rest of us should be living similarly so. By late 1982, most were. By late 1982, she was clearly feeling the strain. In a letter to Martin Marty, she observed, "It was difficult of late for me to keep this thing afloat." As she told Marty, "It seems like I spend the bulk of my time raising funds and financing creditors, and everyone is full of advice. Some of the financial backers want me to make the magazine more popular and less controversial. Others want the review to be more sensational or less sensational. And of course, the church would be glad if we dropped into the ocean and was never heard from again. For the first time in 8 years since we started, I have thought of folding up and becoming a journalist. But every time I suggest such a thing, people around here try to dissuade me. I guess Sunstone is meeting some needs in the Mormon community. For all of its timidity, it is really all there is for most of our readers." In a 1983 note to subscribers, Fletcher commented that this has been a very difficult year. "We've suffered a number of financial setbacks caused by, among other things, the state of the U.S. economy." We always thought globally. Unable to print in January and February, and late with the April-May issue, Fletcher said double issues represented the only way of getting back on schedule. She promised that the June issue of the Sunstone Review will follow closely on the heels of this one. She then went on to thank loyal readers who have remained patiently steadfast. Fletcher ended with the hope that the review might still be printing in the year 2000. While the June issue was out pretty much on schedule, the rest of the year saw only two monthly numbers, September and December, and double issues in July, August, and October, November. As Fletcher had told Martin Marty, everyone was full of advice. One European correspondent, for example, thought he had a solution. Toward the end of the publication's existence, Calvin Aronson suggested to Fletcher that the review accept want ads. In particular, he said, accept want husband, want wife ads. Maybe even want children ads. While Aronson admitted such a policy might offend American sensibilities because it might look like a strange mail-order catalog with pictures and vital statistics, he assured Fletcher that in Germany, the very best newspapers usually have a full page of marriage ads. A second issue revolved around internal tension among staff members, tensions which were often tied to finances and the concerns of financial supporters. By January 1983, Fletcher felt the need to use a staff meeting to respond to concerns from both inside Sunstone and in the larger community. She told the staff that she was trying to meet payroll and assured them, and by extension subscribers and supporters, that neither publication, magazine, or and review would fold. As part of the meeting, she outlined a double issue of the review in February and March, which she said would be a specifically book review issue, with all or most of the issue consisting of book reviews. Fletcher was optimistic that the review would gain more advertising. Aware that the Mormon rumor mill was in full operation, she cautioned the staff to use such meetings as the place to voice complaints, and urged her colleagues to use our time better and become more productive. In a similar vein, Susan Staker told one writer that things had been getting better at Sunstone over the past months. We are no longer in danger of having to quit, but as usual, money is tight. Despite these assurances, the situation continued to worsen. The promised double issue would not appear until April, May, and by June, Fletcher told staffers that starting immediately, the review would be cut to 24 pages and may be cut to 16 for the summer. The review's irregular appearance and diminishing size was not the only significant concern. Throughout the publication's existence, staffers were frequently worried about salaries. As Susan Staker recalls, a few staffers were paid modest hourly wages. While there was some difference in salary, nobody was paid very much. Certainly, Peggy said, an ascetic pattern. Still, as checks either were late or often didn't clear the bank, paid employees, dependent on the money, became angry. Payroll problems also had a tendency to divide the paid staff from unpaid writers and volunteers. Indeed, the latter group was often unaware of the problem. At the same time, if Fletcher had been central to conceiving and creating the review, she was also a problematic figure for some staff members. Many felt that the review and the magazine and the symposium, for that matter, were too closely tied to her personally. Some felt she was too distant, others thought she was autocratic, and still others believed she played favorites. Among some staffers, already uneasy over other issues, there was a certain level of ambivalence and a fear that a cult of personality was developing. In fairness, Fletcher understood these concerns and sought in many ways to delegate responsibilities, broaden the workload, and reassure the staff. Yet, as is the case in many organizations and publications, it isn't easy to strike a balance between the need for a dominant personality whose very presence animates the endeavor and a collective effort. At the same time, among her supporters and critics alike, there was also unanimity that without Fletcher's commitment, Sunstone in all of its forms would not have survived at all. Ironically, recalled Fletcher, while the Sunstone Review was supposed to be a foundation for everything else, it brought a lot of tension, staff tension, money tension. As the staff grew to meet the need, it brought a higher payroll. I sometimes felt like I was driving a chariot with three horses, magazine, symposium, and review. It didn't make the money we thought it would. It competed in terms of energy and resources with other Sunstone projects. It didn't get us out of the hole. What it really did was make us a bigger shoestring organization than before. The review was difficult and expensive. There was a lack of expertise. Maybe it was a doomed idea. While finances and internal tension were difficult, issues confronting the review, something even more troubling emerged on the horizon. As the review began to increase its news coverage, church leaders and bureaucrats put the publication under scrutiny. This development really caught Fletcher off guard, as she recalled later. I really thought the format was less threatening and less highbrow than the magazine itself. I really didn't see the review's coverage of news and current events and happenings as problematic. What I discovered is that news is controversial, especially when it deals with history. Looking back, Fletcher, Staker, and others identified several areas that led to tension between the church and the review. One of the most important was the growing interest in the new Mormon history. Another watershed issue revolved around a November 1982 investigative story on the church in the Denver Post and the review's reporting of that story. The question of the new Mormon history emerged early on. In the second issue of the review, a news story examined a speech by Elder Boyd Packer to seminary and institute instructors on church history. Packer told his listeners that teaching church history represented an unparalleled opportunity to build faith. The review article stated that while not everyone would necessarily agree with Packer's assessment of the primary value of Mormon history as being faith-building, every increasing number of persons and institutions, Mormon and non-Mormon, were becoming involved in this maturing discipline. The article reported that Packer confessed his own dismay at much of the research that has been done recently in the church archives, because so little of the spirit emerges. The article also mentions a lecture given by D. Michael Quinn on Joseph III's 1844 blessing in the Mormons in Utah. Linking Packer and Quinn would prove to be prophetic. In the next issue of the Review, a news story in the annual meeting of the Western History Association reported Lewis Midgley's paper, A Critique of Mormon Historians, The Question of Faith and History. According to the story, Midgley, a BYU professor in the Department of Government, claimed that the common assumption behind the new Mormon history was the belief that you cannot have a good objective history flow from the motive of building the Lord's kingdom or defining the gospel. In response, Jan Schiptz cautioned that the tone and thrust of Midgley's paper led only to the categories of orthodoxy and heresy, labels that hurt the cause of truth. 2 years later, the cover story of the Review posed the question, LDS history in crisis? The Review reported that after years of eager anticipation, a number of troubling events, the cancellation of the multi-volume sesquicentennial history series, transfer of the historical department to BYU, ongoing criticism by Boyd Packer and Ezra Taft Benson, had led to much concern in the historical community. And stories of tensions over history continued throughout the rest of the publication's existence. As noted, the role of historian D. Michael Quinn was especially complicated and controversial. Quinn, then a BYU professor, emerged as the most forthright and visible respondent to the views held by Packer and others. The controversy led Fletcher to write then-apostle Gordon B. Hinckley. She told Hinckley that she felt strongly that the archives should be totally opened and that our historical writing should be impeccably honest. At the same time, she told Hinckley that she felt that there were conflicts that should be worked out among ourselves, ever ambivalent. Fletcher assured Hinckley that neither she nor Sunstone were the source of leaks on these stories. And in fact, she said, she resisted running a story on the firing of Lovina Fielding Anderson from the Ensign, though she believed her dismissal was completely unfair, unnecessary, and just wrong. Telling Hinckley that she believed the church should be completely open and cooperative in such matters, Fletcher stated she hoped Quinn's speech would be published, which it later was, because it was a faithful moving address by a committed son of the church. Another highly significant issue concerned a series of articles on the Mormons published in the Denver Post. Running over a week, the series were written by Post reporter John Farrell. Church public relations officials criticized Farrell's reporting, and a number of LDS readers in Colorado, particularly, protested what they believed was a one-sided and unfair account. In response to the controversy, the Review ran Susan Staker's front-page story behind the Denver Post Mormon story. Staker not only interviewed Farrell and other Post officials, but also Jerry Cahill of the Church Communications Department. Cahill called the story biased. Even though the Sunstone Review story contains serious criticism of the Post's reporting from church liberals like J.D. Williams, Ed Frimmage, and others, it became evident that many in the church hierarchy and the church's bureaucracy felt the Review not only gave the story more visibility, but likely that the Review sympathized with much of what Farrell had written. Indeed, while Williams had criticized Farrell's reporting for failing to interview mainline Mormons, he also said the church must bear a heavy responsibility for the skewing of the article, because they prevented Farrell from interviewing general authorities. Tension. The situation was further exacerbated when it was discovered that copies of the Denver Post series were available for sale at the Sunstone office. In addition to these areas, church officials were constantly bothered by the Review's reporting on a variety of topics, ranging from Sonny Johnson and Mormons for ERA, to East German Communist Mormons and the Temple, to Jean's skirt lengths and hair at BYU. It seemed to many that the publication was staffed by a group of testimony-lacking muckrakers, intent on damaging the church and its image. In retrospect, it's important to remember the polarization of those years. Things were very, very polarized. There was a very strong them versus us mentality. In such an atmosphere, the Sunstone Review was highly suspect. As Fletcher recalled, because we were moving into current events and news, it got us into trouble. All these reporters snooping around and asking questions made some people nervous. There was a church Sunstone access that gave us access to sources. Church bureaucrats knew we had connections and we could find answers. The Denver Post story put us in a position of commenting on them and asking for a response. We were a specifically Mormon publication, asking some tough questions. We were looking at politics, sexuality, gays, the story of anti-Nazi Mormon Helmuth Huebner, and the suppression of a play about him. We were also taking a hard look at the image of the church in the media. Clearly, we were not popular in some quarters. In addition to opposition from the church's bureaucracy and hierarchy, some readers felt that the review was a polarizing influence in the Mormon community. One subscriber wrote to Fletcher saying that she was concerned that the publication showed a lack of respect for the general authorities and was full of negativism. At the same time, the reader went on to say that she worried that copies of the review might end up in inactive and part number homes, where it would fuel the fires of disagreement and distrust that is always beneath the surface in those situations. Similar feelings are expressed in a September 1983 letter to Fletcher from Gail Chandler. A member of Sunstone's National Advisory Committee, Chandler notes she was appalled by articles such as the one dealing with the Broadway play done by the Mormon Gay. Why should he receive free publicity for that production? I believe your article should deal with worthwhile topics. I do not believe the review should be a sounding board for anti-Mormon rhetoric. In addition, Chandler admits she had little support for the review when the cost of publication is so high. I generally read the current events, scan the reviews, and possibly pick out one or two articles of interest. The best of these articles could easily be included in the magazine, in my opinion. Fletcher responded that she disagreed with Chandler's criticism that the review was a sounding board for anti-Mormon rhetoric. Defending the very premises of the publication, Fletcher noted that for her and the staff, knowledge and information give power, good power, and willful ignorance is unnecessary, pathetic, and even anti-gospel. Fletcher told a critic that there was no idea, event, or organization which threatens my existence. On the other hand, the review is reaching an enthusiastic audience as well. Irene Bates, for example, told Fletcher the review was anticipated with as much enthusiasm as the magazine itself. The review, Bates noted, brightens my life for days. Despite these words of support from Bates and others, by early 1984, it became clear that the publication was doomed. The final issue appeared in April 1984. The final issue was dated April 84. It might have appeared in May. Containing long stories by Cecilia Warner on the history of General Conference and a lawsuit involving church critics Gerald and Sandra Tanner. In typical fashion, and realizing that the end was near, the final issue of the review also included 17 book reviews or book notices of titles ranging from The Personal Writings of Joseph Smith to Michael Ann's The Neverending Story. While the review proved to be a failure, it clearly had an impact on Sunstone and on the people who were associated with it. For Sunstone, the review proved to be a serious setback financially. Indeed, it took many years to recoup the money spent on the review and recover from the losses it accumulated. The recollections of former staffers often take into account both the impact of the review on Sunstone as well as on them personally. The recollections of Peggy Fletcher, Albert Peck, Susan Staker, and Nicole Hoffman illustrate the point. All four have gone on to significant careers as writers, journalists, and academics. In looking back, Peggy Fletcher recalled, "I think we were young, idealistic, loyal Mormons who wanted to open up the dialogue with the larger world. Despite the strain of the review on her personally and the impact it had on other Sunstone activities, Fletcher remains proud of what she and her colleagues were trying to accomplish." As she commented, "I thought the review filled a real void. I still think there's a place for such a publication, but it's not being filled. If I were to do it over again, which I am not," she said, "there's no way I would do it the way we did it then. First, we would have had to have had the necessary finances. I still believe every ward in the church has a group of between 2 and 10 people who would be such a publication." Edward Peck agrees, calling the review a great idea. Primarily written by Latter-day Saint authors from an LDS perspective and for an LDS audience, he commented, this forum also expanded Sunstone's tradition of fostering LDS dialogue with the larger religious and scholarly world. Moreover, in assessing the review's contribution, Peck noted that unfortunately the review attracted little advertising and never gained advertising from national publishers. It became a financial liability instead of an asset. Even though this ambitious endeavor was abandoned, Peck stated, the Sunstone Review had a lasting effect on Sunstone Magazine. On the publishing side, the review challenged the foundation to address more than it ever before promotion, distribution, sales, and advertising. Editorially, it took two small magazine departments and magnified the vision of their potential, challenging future editors to regain that legacy. On a more personal level, Susan Staker recalled, I loved it. I thought of myself as a writer. I wanted to write, learn more, make connections between personal experiences and the larger world. It gave me a sense of vindication. I used samples of both Sunstone and the Sunstone Review when I applied for graduate school. The magazine was interesting, but the review was personally important in exploring my own sense of who I was. Nicole Hoffman expressed similar feelings. She recalled her years at Sunstone as a hinge experience, a bridge between raising kids and part-time dabbling in a career. For her, the Sunstone Review was a real catalyst that led to a full-time career. The internal discipline of editing was tremendous, she recalled, and the practical experience was essential. Calling her days at the Sunstone Review a real eye-opener personally, as well as for the church and its intelligentsia, Hoffman concluded, when I think about all we accomplished and remember all the people I met and associated with in those years, it is wonderful and depressing simultaneously. Wonderful and depressing. Not a bad eulogy for the Sunstone Review itself. Thanks.
Okay. Well, I was a little surprised to see myself listed to make comments because I agreed, I thought, only to chair. But I have a few, I told them I'd be available for comments, I think. But I have a few observations, actually, having been there and gone through at least part of the experience. First of all, when John and I talked a few days ago, John said, and this is in reference to Peggy saying that she had this revelatory experience in response to her wondering why Sunstone wasn't making the magazine and was not expanding its readership. Lots of people were egging me on, basically, to start the review. And he said, Larry, did you egg her on? I thought, that wasn't my experience, actually. I remember being pretty cynical about starting it up, thinking that we were way too overextended. And this brings me to one point I want to make in the paper, John. I think it would be helpful to maybe give a little bit of a chronology or a listing of staff members and what they do. I think it would punctuate the fact that how overextended we were. There are very few of us working on it. And we came and went as well. The other factor that added, I think, to the tension, well, let me say a few more things about how overextended we were and just give you a couple of examples. I'm artistically challenged. I just make no bones about it. And yet, although we had a professional who volunteered, I can't remember who it was, who did the initial design?
Yeah, I can't remember.
Yeah. Anyway, he did the sort of addition, the sort of this is what the review will look like, you know, the banner and designed the individual pages. I ended up pasting it up. I mean, I didn't even know that you could buy lines. This is pre-computer, you know, that you could buy lines. And I remember sitting in the Bennett building at midnight one night all by myself with all the slicks, you know, you used to have to get the slicks off the typesetting machine, which, by the way, Susan Staker not only wrote, but she did all the typesetting for the most part. And I remember sitting on the floor weeping, literally crying, saying, this looks like and I won't say the expletive, this looks like a, this looks like a, because I didn't know what I was doing. And if you look at the first few copies of the review, I think you'll agree.
Oh, yeah.
It looks really bad. And then, fortunately, Brian Bean came on later on. And, but that's the sort of thing. And I think it might give some texture and flesh out why there were some tensions. I mean, that, when you're in, when you're involved in something where you're passionate about it and you want it to be wonderful, but you're incapable, I mean, you're spread too thin, and you're doing, you may be talented in one area, but you're doing something that you, I remember just being frustrated a lot because I felt like I got roped into doing things that I wasn't really qualified or capable of doing sometimes. Okay. Another point I want to make is that without taking in any way away from Peggy's unsurpassed vision and networking abilities, I mean, I can't say enough good about that. I want to emphasize, in fact, I can't stress it enough, Susan Staker's role. She was the driving force behind the actual hands-on production of the review and the magazine for a long time. And I think it might be helpful to emphasize that. I mean, she was the workhorse. She did it all, and competently. That's what's so amazing. And particularly before Elbert signed on, because Elbert wasn't there for the very beginning, is my experience. Is that true? Yeah, and that might, again, that might be helpful in what I said before. Nicole Hoffman joined us later as well. So, and then I left in the middle of it, too. I got married and moved to Chicago. But anyway,
it was really like a flooding craft
game. It was. It was. And here's another thing that I think might be important to bring out. With the review, because of the demands of the review, I mean, think about it. She envisioned it being a Time magazine, and I remember that, you know, and the New York Review of Books sort of combined. You know, staff problems, I mean, finances were the key, and you've emphasized that, I think, sufficiently. But, you know, you have to have a sufficient staff to make something like that work. And with the review, and I think this is an important point, paid staffers who saw Sunstone as a job rather than a cause came on. And I think that caused some of the tensions in terms of money. I mean, there were times when I just didn't get paid. But I was okay with that because for me it was a cause. But there were, with the review, there were staffers brought on who were not as invested emotionally and intellectually in the process. Don't you agree?
I agree.
Yeah? Okay. And
often they were in the advertising and business part, and so they would quit, and then we'd start all over again.
Yeah. I think that caused a lot of the tension and difficulty. And then to this, I mean, maybe we can talk about this a little bit. Maybe you all can help us respond to this. But I don't know that the church was, we were so polarized at the time. Maybe I was idealistic and couldn't see it. But I don't think the church quite knew what to do with us or how to position itself immediately. Because this is a little different, because we were journalists, and so historically journalists are suspect, and yet we were insiders, and I'm not sure the church quite, it was sort of a new venture, don't you think?
Oh, yeah.
And so maybe it took a while for them to know quite what to do with us, and I think about that. I mean, you may be right, but it seems like things are much more polarized now than they were then. And we could call the guys, and they talk to us, and, you know.
Yeah.
But I don't know, you might want to think about that. You may be right. Okay. I think those are a few of the points that I hope that's helpful.
That's
in. Okay. We have, 2 minutes for questions, I guess, a couple minutes?
You mentioned the fact that, I don't know the whole context of the story, but you mentioned the fact that you think that in one sense this was really bad for Sunstone because so much money was lost and so forth. Would it be possible to take the other interpretation and say, well, this was a time with many controversial stories, and the review served as a lightning rod, and therefore the magazine, Sunstone, did not get a bad rap?
Well, maybe, but I think the important thing is to is what Albert said. It was a difficult thing for Sun Tzu. We didn't have the finances. We didn't have the staff. We didn't have the expertise. And we just overextended blithely in many ways. Incredibly so. The kind of thing you do when you're in your 20s and 30s that you don't do when you're in 50. You say, my hell, what about this, 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 and this? But what it forced Sunstone then to do, the best parts went back in the magazine, and it forced Sunstone to it challenged Sunstone to think about things we never really thought about, distribution, advertising, all kinds of things. So the legacy is both good and bad. But the legacy financially, it was bleak. I mean, it was really a major hit financially. As to Lori's point, let me just comment about the polarization. It's an interesting question. I mean, I just remember it as ERA and Sonia Johnson and Mark Hoffman and one, and maybe I'm sort of remembering it that way. And indeed, there is another side to it. Bill Evans, who was the secretary of the church's special affairs committee, which was sort of the investigative group that kind of kept their eye on all these things. One of my favorite memories of Sunstone is at a Sunstone symposium, and the chair of the session comes up and says, "I have a message, Bill Evans. Will you please call your office?" Well, in some ways, it wasn't as polarizing. We could call those people, and they could call us. But when it got polarizing, everybody was suspect. Yet, were the press suspect generally? Yes. But when we started asking questions and commenting on general authorities and church finances and bringing in these non-Mormons to, say, Zion and Gomorrah, that really raised a lot of difficulty. Looking back, it's been a real interesting experience for me to go back and look at something from a very different perspective than I had. I was as devoted to the cause as anyone was. But when you look back at it, it really looks different to you. It had a tremendous impact. Not all negative, I think, is my short answer to your question. Not all negative. And if you haven't ever seen Issues of the Review, take a look at it. It's fun. Every once in a while, the line that's pasted up goes like that. That's okay. It's kind of charming.
Are there copies in special collections, like the Marion Library?
Yes, yes. And there are still some copies at the Sunstone office, I think. And it's worth kind of looking through. And for me, going back to the Sunstone archives at the University of Utah and reading letters I'd written in 1982 and letters I'd received one last thing, I know we're out of time. Peter Wiley, for example, and Bob Gottlieb's book, Empires in the Sun and America's Saints, never were reviewed really in the magazine. Empires never was, and the review was only somewhat reviewed, as I recall. And we had written to Peter, would you like to review William Reich for us? Or some high-tony kind of thing that had nothing to do with what we're doing. And Peter's response was, I'd love to review that, but what about reviewing my book that deals with... I mean, it was such an odd combination of what we were doing, and in part because we really, I don't think, knew what we were doing, really. But we had some pretty good ideas on where we were going.
Thanks very much, John.